Welcome back to On Delmarva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. Today, you'll hear my recent interview with Cambridge, Maryland Mayor Victoria Jackson Stanley. She's the first African-American and first woman to be elected mayor of Cambridge. Here she is describing her background.
I come from humble beginnings. Never forgot where I came from. My daddy always said, he's dead now. I think I might have mentioned that before. The people you meet on the way up are the same ones you meet on the way down. And I added a little twist to that. And I want to be able to look that all those people in the eye.
No matter which way you're going.
No matter how I'm going. On my way down, I want to be able to say, hey, how you doing as I'm going down, and not feel ashamed that I mistreated anybody. You know, that's sort of the long explanation from that little statement.
Your father, you mentioned him again, is Fred Jackson.
Fred Jackson. Frederick Douglass Jackson, Jr. I'm claiming that he was named after Frederick Douglass.
Why not?
My grandmother never said otherwise, so I will claim that.
He was an amazing man, your dad.
Yes. Yes, he was. He was...
He was tall and stood tall.
Tall, big, statuous, very, very black man. You know, if you're wearing black, I always say he's as black as your turtleneck. And he was a very positive man, well-loved by a lot of people, and feared by some, too. He was a truant officer, and he had that reputation.
Was he? That's something I never knew. He was a truant officer.
He was a truant officer back in the 60s. One of the non-professionals, but a professional in the Board of Education. He didn't have a college degree, but he had such chutzpah, using a good word that I like to use every now
word.
And then.
It's a good word.
He had a reputation of being fair, but he didn't take much stuff, particularly out of kids. And kids knew he cared.
I can see your father, having known him a little bit when I was a teenager here in Cambridge, I could see your father being a truant officer and being inside, internally, morally outraged that young black kids especially would not be in school.
Education was his thing.
It was like,
you know.
We're talking about the early 60s here, too.
The early 60s, you know, he fought and was humiliated a lot of times during that time because of his belief that children should have equal, fair, and quality education. And there was no reason why you couldn't go to school. So it was his almost mission. Some of the kids then are adults now, and they would tell me, your father would chase us across the field and make us go to school. And if we got away from him, he'd show up at our house and tell my mom that I was out of school and, you know, I was in trouble because of Fred Jackson. He was infamous. Very few people, I guess he was famous, but infamous is a word too. He would be the person that would be the go-to guy. If you needed something for your kids, you go to Fred Jackson. Fred Jackson did not take anything for granted. He worked hard. He was the crab picker. When you have those little specialty crab claws, he was the crab claw guy.
He worked
in the crab
too.
House. Oh, yeah, he did that in the morning. He would... his story was he'd pick crabs in the morning, get cleaned up, go to school, get cleaned up, go to school all day, and then go back to the crab house to make money to buy his school clothes. So we had that work ethic of you get up, you go to school, do what you have to do. My sister and two brothers always had the message, you can, once you get it up here, meaning education in your head, they can't take that from you, whoever they are.
Right.
But they can take your job, you can take your possessions, but once you get education, you can go far. And that's the message we had, and that's the message he gave to all the kids in our community. Not a week goes by that I have not heard his name used by someone, and you're using his name now. He's been dead 27 years.
Really?
Yeah. So that's the kind of...
Died young.
Yeah, he died of colon cancer.
Oh, really?
Colon cancer, diabetes complicated it. And he died in his early 50s.
But your mother's still with you.
Yeah, my mother's still
alive. Betty,
Betty L. Jackson.
Right.
Betty Jackson, and she'll be 75 very soon. She has a birthday coming up. And she was that wind beneath his wings. He was allowed by her to do the things that he did, and she would watch the children and take care of the family, and she worked every day too.
What did she do?
Let's see. When I was a little girl, she worked in the sewing factory. She was a presser, She still presses clothes. We want something done. We get mom to do the ironing for us.
Still.
And she takes great pride in that, too. You know, she's got all of her faculties, and she's now a great-grandmother of four. But back then, she then got a job at the Board of Education driving the little yellow bus. You've heard that story, mm-hmm. The little yellow bus. But the special needs kids were the kids she drove to school, and she got a lot of pleasure out of that, too. Everything has always been children-focused in my family. After that, she worked at one of the local factories. Daddy got really sick, so she had to take a job that would accommodate taking care of him in the daytime, working at night, and then she'd get home in time to take care of him. But then he died December 5th, was a Tuesday, 1984, at 11 o'clock in the morning.
Mm.
Was that significant for me or what?
Clearly it was. I'm not surprised it was, obviously.
Well, he was the role model for us all. As you said, he was very tall, very black, very statuesque. I think he was 6'2", but he had this major shadow that he cast upon the community.
And he was really the right hand, the stalwart, the man who stood up behind, the lieutenant to Gloria Richardson in the Cambridge Nonviolent Action Group.
There were lots of lieutenants. But he was my daddy, so he was the most important lieutenant because he was my daddy.
He may have been the most important lieutenant, actually, but
he may have. I was a kid, so I really can't say just what his role was. But I do remember, for the years of the civil rights movement that I remember as a kid, he was always in the movement. He always was there, beating the drum of equal rights and making sure that his children got a quality education. And all the children around him, if he was going to have anything to do with it.
So when you tell this story, and we hear the stories about your dad and your mom both, mm-hmm. you almost had no choice but to be who you are, and to become what you've become.
Well, possibly.
We all have choices, but you know,
we have choices.
Right.
My choice was to do something for my community. That was always my vision, my dream. I would go away to college. I went to Salisbury State, so I didn't go very far, as someone
You must be one of the early African-American students there.
Yeah, I was, I think they tell me I was part of the first group of African-Americans that lived on campus.
Wow.
They opened up the campus back in like 70, something like that. I don't remember exactly, but in 71, when I graduated from high school, we were one of the few blacks on the campus. There may have been maybe 10 on the entire campus. Therefore, we were a close-knit group. And we started the first black student union at Salisbury State. A friend of mine, you know, and that was quite the accomplishment. The president was very forward-thinking. Norman Crawford, I think was his name. And we petitioned and told him we needed something for the black community of the campus. And he was sort of a party guy like us. And he went with it. And it was a really good experience for us. We bonded together. We had an identity on the campus. And they've changed the name, but there's still an organization like that at Salisbury University.
For black students, African-American students.
Yeah. I'm not sure what it's called anymore. I don't go back to Salisbury too often. When I do go back, I understand that there is such an organization. And I feel kind of proud that, yeah, I didn't have a choice. I had to do something for the community that I live. And that was just one of the things my daddy taught us. You take pride in yourself, and you do for your community.
And then you went to Howard University and got your MSW.
Went to Howard University in 1979. Graduated in 81 with a master's in social work.
Here you are, mayor of Cambridge,
mm-hmm. True.
An important town in Delmarva, in the Eastern Shore.
Yes.
And you still have a full-time job.
Yes, I do.
As a social worker.
Well, I'm an administrator. I don't do social work.
But in
the sense anymore, but yeah, but I'm an administrator.
Right. I have a full-time job.
I have a full-time job. Yes, I do. The mayor of Cambridge grosses $12,000. That's our salary. But like I said earlier, off air, my councilman and I agreed to take a voluntary cut in our pay so we could put money back into the coffers.
10%, you said?
10%. It equates to like $6,000 in the coffers. You know, my councilmen don't get a lot of money either. But we feel it's our contribution to keeping some money in our budget. So there might be things that we need to do. And that's our contribution that, you know, they agreed to it. And I think it's a good idea. And I'm very proud of my council.
So you have two full-time jobs.
Well,
don't you?
Actually, yes.
Yes.
I get to social services at 7 every morning. I work until 11 in the morning. I come directly here at City Hall, work until 1, go back to social services. You know, that commute, it's only 2-3 minutes from the building. And then I work at social services until 5 normally. And then from that point, I come back to City Hall and wrap up whatever's left to be done, check my email, return phone calls. Go to evening meetings. Weekends, I come in on Saturday. I don't do Sundays. Sundays is my spiritual vitamin day. But then there are evening meetings. And so far, 2.5 years, I've been able to juggle
years.
That. 2.5 years.
So, so being mayor of a community like Cambridge, 11,000, 12,000, 13,000 people, whatever it ends up being after the census, you had a lot of ideas and dreams for this job when you took it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, I did. And those dreams and visions, I had a vision for the future of our community. They're still out there. I'm still plugging away at it. Of course, the economy has been the interesting twist. We've had several challenges that have been brought to this council and myself that have put a defer on the visions that we've had. When I got to this job, I had this vision of a youth center, a community center
with
children.
Right, I remember you saying that, right.
I even had the perfect location. I had an organization who developed their dream of what that vision would look like in reality. And I still have that that piece of paper that came to this guy in a dream. He said, "Mayor, God told me that this is what you needed." And he handed me this piece of paper. So it's still there. And whenever I get an opportunity to tell anyone about it, it's going to cost some money. And the children deserve a place where they can go to say, "Hey, we have some place to go." Other visions.
Let me ask the question. I'm going to hear all the visions and see where we are with them. But So this vision of a youth center.
Yes.
So where is it? And I mean, what is the budget of Cambridge, man? What's your budget?
Our general fund budget is a little over $11 million. It used to be closer to 13, but with some of the various cuts that we've had with highway user, that was cut like 800,000. We had 800,000. We now have 80,000. So that was a significant cut. Police cuts, just all over the place. We've had to deal with various cuts. So we're a little over $11 million in our general fund.
So what does it take to build a rec center, to build a center for young people, to build a place that you...
If we build it the way I want to build it,
yeah,
it would be closer to $1.2 million. That would be inclusive of all of the materials inside it. That would be parking, landscaping, programs, activities. That would be part of just the general operation. You know, we have to not just build it, but we have to sustain it as well. So that would be inclusive of that.
Can Cambridge like float a bond or have a bond issue?
Yes, we've looked at that. But as I understand it, a bond bill really is a little more intricate than I assumed. But there are things that I am working on that I'm not going to give to you. I won't give you that exclusive just yet. But there will be an opportunity for us to look at various avenues of how to fund many of the things that I'd like to see get off the ground here in Cambridge. But with the economy turning around the way it is, it's going to take some time. And we are going to succeed. We're at ground zero, so we can only go up from here. I'm a be positive person.
That's good. So your other part of your wish list?
Other part of my wish list, jobs, 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 jobs. We have lost so many jobs in the last few years. The manufacturing industry is drying up the way it used to be, very vibrant here in Cambridge. So we have to look at a new way of getting employment for our residents. We're looking at retail. The entertainment field is really up and coming in this area. museums. We're a very historic area. And looking at the historic recognition, making Cambridge a destination is one of the things we're looking at. Also green jobs. We have a new vocational technological school that's going to be opening. I believe the county will be having it ready for the fall of 2011. The high school has a whole new perspective with the Votech school now. So green jobs will be something that will be a major focus of mine. You would say I'm a green candidate, if that was such a thing anymore.
Mm-hmm. It still is.
It still is, right. So we're building our workforce to look at the emerging jobs that are coming down the pike. Because we live in such a fabulous area, we're, 2 hours from Washington or Baltimore, 3 hours from Philadelphia, 3 from Norfolk. We're in a prime location, but we have to make sure we market ourselves. And then, once we get that attention, have the workforce available to have the job and the employees when they come. I believe in marketing the good of our community. Other things we have on the horizon, our port property is being redeveloped. We're working with the Port Authority and the Maryland Department of Transportation, civil engineers. I don't know what you call them exactly, but we're working with a lot of the state and federal level organizations to really redevelop our port property. We have a beautiful waterfront. I'm not going to sell our community, but I want to redevelop it and revitalize the importance of our area. As I said, a destination. You know, we're the home, the county is the home of Harriet Tubman.
Yes.
And the Harriet Tubman Byway, the federal national byway, is here. So Cambridge has got to be ready for what's coming for us. And I really want to give a call out to our legislators. We're still here. We still want to get that state and federal support to get that byway a reality. It's going to be a very, very important piece of activity. One of our commissioners said in a recent article about his business that you should offer something that others are not doing to keep people coming back and to keep people wanting what you have to offer. And when I read that in the local paper, I thought, you know, that is exactly the mission or the vision that I have for us. We in Cambridge are in competition with so many other municipalities. It's our role to really present a community, a safe community. We don't want no disrespect to my sisters and brothers in our neighboring areas, we don't want the violence of Baltimore or even some of our closer municipalities to really mar our very family-oriented environment. So it's a delicate balance. I want progress, but I want progress that's safe, progressive, and culturally pleasing to those who would come here. We have locals like myself. You know, I've got 7 generations I've counted that I've attended my church.
7 generations?
Can go back. With my grandson, it would be 7. Wow. It's my grandson, my daughter, myself, my father, my father's father, his father. I found the slaves, by the way, in my community. I'm so excited about that.
You found what?
The slaves. You know, the black slave plantation. I found the names of the slaves that I have a direct line in my family tree. I was so excited when I found them. I tell everybody, Isaac and Mariah were the slaves in my Jackson family.
And where were they?
They were on the Radcliffe Plantation in Beckwith, Maryland. Beckwith area. It's here in Dorchester County. I've not found the plantation personally, you know, to step foot on the grounds at somebody's house, you know. But I was so excited to even think that I was so close to that. And I planned with my family to explore that even more.
How did you find it?
Oral history. The oral history of my family. The oldest member of my Jackson family tree just turned 100 last year. Wow. And before, you know, she became very frail, and she's in a nursing home now, she was telling us about the Jacksons and the names of all of the families. And because our bloodline is the same, her father was my grandfather's uncle or something, you know, something like that. But as the more she talked, the more I could piece together the names of the names that are part of my family. So, yeah, Mark, I have a vested interest in this community. I may not get everything I want, but if I don't ask for it, no one will ever know.
So. Do you ever think about... I was thinking about it when you were talking about Harriet Tubman, who came from here.
Dorchester County.
Dorchester County. Not from Cambridge, but from Dorchester County.
Right.
And you as the first woman and first African-American to be mayor of Cambridge, a town with a pretty divided and horrendous racial history.
True.
The bookends that the two of you are.
Isn't that fascinating? And Harriet Tubman was that role model for me growing up. I always knew about her. You know, we didn't talk about it in school, but I knew about her, and she was that role model for me. She was born and raised here. She went away, and she came back, and she kept coming back. She didn't stay, you know, but the fact that she did something for her community, for her family, was the role model that I took away of Harriet Tubman. She was tough. I'm not as tough as she was, clearly. I'm not sure if I could live that time and survive.
She was smart.
She was smart. She was charismatic, the way she got people to do what she wanted them to do. She was rather dangerous as well, because I understand she had a gun, and if you did not cooperate, you were threatened with your life.
That's right.
I'm not quite that part.
You don't carry a gun?
I do have a gun. I do. I have a 22 pearl-handled pistol my daddy gave me. The gun is in some part of the house, and the bullets are someplace else. And we were taught to shoot as children because it was the late 50s, 60s. Remember the turbulent times of the 60s. Our daddy would take us out to the junkyard, and our job was to track and shoot the rats that were in the junkyard. But back to Harriet Tubman. Mm-hmm. Harriet Tubman was almost notorious for her courage and her determination. If I have a minuscule amount of the determination that she had, I would be a happy person. I am a happy person because I think I have that kind of minuscule amount of determination and courage. It's not easy sometimes remembering the things that have had to happen in order to get me in this seat. But I don't take it for granted. There were those who were very supportive of me getting this job as mayor. They believed in me before I did. It's like, oh, Vicki, you can do this. We got your back. Okay, we'll see. But a friend of mine, Melvin Jews, is an attorney. He's the one who talked me into this. Melvin said, Vicki.
Into running.
Mm-hmm. Vicki, it's your campaign to win or to lose. And you have to want it. It's like, Melvin, let somebody else do it, doggone it. You know,
you beat a sitting mayor.
I'm sorry?
You beat a sitting mayor.
I know. Isn't that wild? It's not done. It's just not done. I'm an unknown. I'm known, but I'm unknown.
You're unknown, untried politically.
Yes.
But, yes. Right.
But it's just not done. An unknown. I have had some political aspirations.
Mm-hmm.
I've been on board of directors on statewide labor unions, and I've been very visible and vocal in some of the things that go on in our community. I'm very spiritual, so I'm very involved with my church and my sorority and yada, yada, yada. But it's just not done. You don't upseat an incumbent two-term mayor by someone like me. So... I'm sorry.
No, because there's a dozen things I want to ask you, and I'll get through most of them, I think, in the course of the interview, about the city of Cambridge and the changes you want to see and what Cambridge is trying to do to make itself a different city, and also these things you're bringing up now. You're becoming mayor, a black woman, becoming mayor of Cambridge, Maryland, 2 years ago, unseating the mayor who is here, who is a white man, not to make it a racial issue, because I'm not trying to do that.
It's not racial.
But the issue is not racial, but the change of power is very significant. I mean, this is an area that was historically run by older white men.
323 years.
Right. I mean, look at Somerset County. They just elected their first countywide African-American official in the 320-some-year history of the county.
Right.
Right?
Right.
And you're now mayor of Cambridge.
Yes.
So that is a significant... And you're a woman, so you bring not just, for want of a better term, African-American-ness to this office, but your womanness to this office in terms of perspective of how...
It's not lost on me. I know exactly what you're trying to say. That the mold of the mayor has been broken. I didn't understand the reality. I didn't accept the significance, I guess that's better put, the significance of the election. For the longest time, I had work to do. This, you know, I've got this job, I want to do it well. You know, the world will be watching. And it didn't really become a significant event for me until I went to one of the schools. And I walked in, and it's like I'm giving a speech to the kids, blah, 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 blah. And the children were like, "You're the mayor." It's like, "Yes, yes, I am." And they were just taken with that idea. You know, old people like you and I, you know, we take change as it comes. But the children, and then I remembered myself as a child and the significance of the activity of the day. And I saw myself in Wikipedia. I think that's how you say it.
Wikipedia.
That.
I saw you in Wikipedia too.
I couldn't believe it. It's like, oh my God. Oh my God. I'm in Wikipedia. You know, when I Google people, I go to Wikipedia and I Google them. And can you imagine seeing your face? And it's like, oh no. Okay. This is a big deal. Because of my background, I assume things are going to work out the way they're supposed to. But my role in them is not that significant. There's a greater power than I, and I accept my role in the universe. But when I saw my face in Wikipedia, it took me back. And then the kids were like, "Oh, you're the mayor." It's like, "Yeah." And it's like, "Oh, it's the mayor." It's like, they're excited. They're excited. So, yeah, it's a big deal.
Your symbol and your reality.
Yes.
Both.
Right. And that's kind of scary. It is.
It's a lot to carry.
It's not heavy.
No, but it's crazy? But it's a lot to carry. Not heavy.
It's not heavy. It's not heavy. I told someone recently, I love this job. I didn't think I would love the job.
So
I love the job.
We're here, by the way, in Cambridge, Maryland, with the mayor of Cambridge, Victoria Jackson Stanley. You're listening to On Del Marva on WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. We're going to take a very brief break, and we'll be right back to hear the rest of our conversation with Cambridge Mayor Victoria Jackson Stanley. The Mark Steiner Show is made possible by the Maryland Parkinson's Disease and Movement Disorders Center, providing clinical research trials that evaluate new therapies and the latest treatment options, including surgical intervention for advancing stages of disease. The number for more information is 1-800-492-5538. Welcome back to On Del Marva. I'm your host, Mark Steiner. We're going to get right back to our interview with the mayor of Cambridge, Maryland, Victoria Jackson Stanley. She was elected mayor of our hometown in 2008, making her both the first woman and first African-American to hold that office. Before the break, we were talking about how she approaches what is both a demanding six-day-a-week job as well as a history-making position. When you said that it's not heavy... It's not heavy, but it's a huge responsibility. Everything that's represented through you.
I agree. Yes, but
that doesn't have to be heavy because you come at it with a very spiritual. I'm going to say not light. It's not lighthearted, but you come at it with a very spiritual light in terms of what you're trying to bring here. Just the way you approach it, your self-deprecating way of even looking at yourself.
The reason that it's not heavy goes to the point of my spirituality. God's will, it's done. And, there's an and, there's no but. And, the people that work in the city of Cambridge do an outstanding job at what they do. the councilmen, and they're five councilmen, brilliant men. I call them brilliant. They're brilliant men. Five councilmen of the city of Cambridge are brilliant. Remember I said that. They are talented in their own rights. They all have their talents. And the employees of the Dorchester County Department of Social Services do their job very, very well. It's not heavy for me, or the burden is light, because I work with them as they do their job. And we all have our roles. And as social services does their thing, and the people at the city of Cambridge do their thing, my role is to be the buck stops here?
Yes. Harry Truman.
Harry Truman. I wanted to say Roosevelt, but I thought I was wrong. Harry Truman. With the city of Cambridge, the buck stops with me. I don't get to vote on ordinances and things like that, because the actual power in the city of Cambridge are the councilmen. They make all the decisions and they vote, but I facilitate the meetings. I am the face of the city of Cambridge. At Social Services, my boss, Bill McDonald, who is the director of the agency, has allowed me to balance my world the best I can, making sure that the work of social services gets done and I don't misrepresent that I am the mayor at social services. I am never the mayor at social services. Do not call for the mayor at social services. You will be told, I'm sorry, you called City Hall. That way, everyone knows their role. And I know my role is mayor at City Hall and deputy director of social services at Dorchester County Department of Social Services itself. And I'm comfortable with myself knowing that I can't do all things. And these guys know what they're doing, so I let them do their work.
So when you have a vision of a green city, mm-hmm. and I've been reading that there's been all these discussions in Cambridge, Maryland, about trying to build a sustainable community.
Yes.
Trying to not spread the city out to eat up farmland, but to develop...
Infill. Yes.
The city.
That is my vision. To take the interior that is right now vacant or underdeveloped and build from within. It's going to be a tough sell for some developers, because if you have green land, they tell me it's easier to build out than to renovate or revitalize it. So they say. But for me, I think if you use what you have and use the resources that are available to you, it will only beautify the community. Beautification is recycling in my book. You know, take some of the vacant buildings and put something that will enhance the community. And then as we grow and expand, we'll bud from the inside out. That's sustainability to me. Infill, if it's working, will work well. If we look at the interior of our community and just have smart growth. I think that was Governor Ehrlich's real message. He believed in smart growth. Governor O'Malley has continued that particular message, and I'm a full supporter.
Right. I think it was Governor Glenn Denning who actually spoke.
Glenn Denning. One of those Republican governors.
One of those guys.
He was a governor.
Well, that's actually, that's refreshing what you just said, though, in the sense that you're not worried about what goes on outside of here in many ways. Your focus is on Cambridge, Maryland.
Well, I have to look at the entire world, but my job is the mayor of Cambridge. Now, if I can liberally borrow from some of the good things that are happening in Annapolis or Washington, I want to be able to use the resources available to us to make this community great.
Can you give us an honest assessment from your perspective on what the state of relations are between the black and white communities in this town now? 40 years later, you're elected from the time of Gloria Richardson and even the kind of more explosive times when Rap Brown was here, and that happened in the late 60s and when you were still a child here. How is that? Where are we now, do you think? What's the honest assessment of how we are now in Cambridge?
You know, that's the toughest question I've had to deal with. Not that I don't know the answer, mm-hmm. but I come from a different perspective. From my perspective, our community is binding together like We haven't in the past. But we have still so much to do economically. It's more. It's not so much black-white. It's more economics. We have people who are underemployed or unemployed, and a lot of them happen to be African-American. And because they have fewer educational resources that they can build on to really be that workforce we need, you know, that's the answer. The answer is it's about green. But your straight question deserves a straight answer. The community at large has improved in our bonding and working together. There are still remnants of the old way, the old thinking. You know, there are those in the black community who don't trust talking to white people. There are those in the white community who may use negative terms as they describe a black person. They haven't done that to me directly. You know, I've never been called the N-word to my face. To my face.
Ever.
Ever. Maybe as a kid, maybe. I don't know. I don't remember. Uh-huh. And I think that's because I was isolated. My dad and mom cocooned us from that negativity. But there are those who were not cocooned. And I'm reality-based to know that there are people out there who are still hurting based on those days. Slowly but surely, we're getting out of it. Our younger people are having more opportunity to bond and to blend our vision and our relationships. And it's going to take a little more time. It's only been, what, 40, 50 years? 40 years?
40 years.
40 years. This town is 325, 26 years old. And it's going to take a little more time, but we're better than we were. You know, we don't have that same kind of hostility, but well, we have more that we can do.
When I was with the mayor of Chestertown a month or so ago at her office and talking
Margo
to her.
Margo Bailey.
Yes, Margo Bailey. And she had some people in her, a couple of her constituents, a white woman, African-American man, who were, and what they were talking about is they were talking about they're doing something that's almost tantamount to one of a better term, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, of trying to have people talk honestly about what happened in the past and where we're going as a town.
It's the time which has come. We've had small steps like that. We had our Masons.
The Masons.
Prince Hall Masons,
the African-American
we
Masons.
We have Prince Hall Masons, and then we have the Pride of Masons. I don't know all of these terms, but the Black Masons and the White Masons.
Right.
Got together last year and had a fish fry as a fundraiser to make a donation to, I think, our cold weather shelter, one of my particular focuses.
For the homeless.
For the homeless. We have a shelter for the homeless. And that was the first time the Black and the White Masons did something as a group last year. So my point is, it's slowly coming. Having a Black mayor has really been a benefit, I hope, because people are saying, well, we can't hold it against, it's not the man anymore. I am not the man. Okay?
You're not the man, no.
I don't care how you slice it. You look at me, I'm Black. I'm not
And
Black.
Not a man.
And I am not a man. But I try to be lighthearted. I'm a B positive. My blood type is B positive. And I try to impress upon people that we are in this together. You know, the sins and the drama and the problems of the past, we are not going to forget them. We are not going to ignore them. But we are not going to hold on to that past to the point that it will keep us from moving forward. And we've got to move forward. We cannot stay where we were. And it's going to take time for those who were wounded. There were people who were wounded, particularly in the Black community.
Right.
I talk with them a lot. Because I work so much, I go home and I crash. I'm like, I don't get up like I would like to, but I'm not isolated from what's going on around me. I just want to have people understand that in order for us to progress, we cannot hold on to the pain of the past. We've got to work through it. And it sounds like that's what Margo Bailey is doing, working through the pain of the past, which is really the only way you're going to get anything done. You can't ignore it. You can't overlook it. You can't pretend it never happened. It happened. As you said, that past made me who I am.
Right.
I was stronger. I'm wiser. But I couldn't have done it without a lot of people.
You mentioned the shelter. That's one of your passions.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm curious about that. I mean, what are the issues in this community with
We have homeless people in our community, men, women, black, white families even. And a few years ago, I guess it was 5 years ago, way before I became mayor, I do work with various groups in the community, churches. We called ourselves the community service providers. It was a group of the professionals, emergency management, the police, health department, and the churches came together. And one of the things that I could see as my social services hat, that there were homeless in the community that had no place to go when it was very cold. So we talked to some of the churches in our area, and it's moved around a little bit. But one of the things that we developed as a community group was to establish an emergency cold weather shelter. It evolved into a December 1st through March 31st, 7 day a week, from 6 p.m. until 8 a.m. shelter for those who would have nowhere to go when the elements became frigid. It was very important last year when we had the two blizzards back to back. There were places for our homeless to go. And the community groups the community groups of Cambridge and Dorchester County voluntarily bring in meals every night, Monday through Sunday, to feed those people. And that sometimes is the only meal they get until the soup kitchens of the various churches open up for lunch.
So how pervasive and deep is poverty and unemployment in this community?
The unemployment of Dorchester County is about 10%. It's decreased in the last year or so. As I said, the economy is starting to turn around again, but we're still pretty impoverished. I think out of 24 counties, we're at like 22, 23 of the unemployment rate. And it's getting better, I say reluctantly, almost straining to really convince the community that we are getting better. Right now it's just not working as fast as some people want. We have homeless, we have impoverished people, we have homeless families. You know, a man, woman, and three kids were at our shelter not long ago. Luckily they were able to find more suitable, reliable housing, so that was good for them.
So how do you, as the visionary, as a leader of this community now, as mayor of this community, you have 2 more years in office before you have to run again, if you decide to run again.
Yes.
How do you balance this idea that you talked about earlier of developing the waterfront, developing the older parts of Cambridge, and dealing with employment and poverty? And people see a waterfront going up, but their homes are still there, where they live in poverty.
It's a very interesting and delicate balance that you've presented. I'm glad you put it in that way. On one end, we have the waterfront, which will be the crown jewel of our community. If we do it and we do it well, we will be able to bring people to our community that will infuse dollars. And on the other hand, we have Department of Public Works and our commissioners working with those within our community and the landlords to improve the lot of those that are living in our community. You know, we have to balance and remember that the money that comes in the community has to be used in the community.
How do those people who live in poverty in this town, be they white or black, whoever they are, how do they benefit from this development?
They will benefit when there's an infusion of money to build different recreational facilities, to increase the quality of safety in our community, garbage collection, all kinds of things that will help our budget increase, and then also make sure that the services that we provide to them are sustained, or if not improved. Housing has also been one of my bugaboos, if that's a word. To improve the housing lot in our community will have a direct impact on how we look at the quality of life for those that live in Cambridge.
So is the development you're thinking of, does this put people to work in Cambridge immediately? In other words,
people who live in Cambridge are the people I'm talking about. The services that we have available to those who live in Cambridge is how my vision really has been grounded. I want our people who come and live, or who were born and raised here and decided to stay, to have that quality of life improved. We can't do it without money. That's why it's got to be a balance. As we infuse money into our community through tourism or through jobs, retail, whatever, as money comes into our community, it's going to filter to those who live here. We open, I don't know, Walmart is expanding to be a superstore. They're going to employ more people. Those people that are going to be hired will be living, hopefully, in the city of Cambridge. So if you have a job, you'll be able to improve your quality of life. It's a balance. There's no question. As I infuse, or as I envision the infusion of money into our community, it's going to ripple to all of us. What do they say? A rising tide lifts all boats. So as our economy improves, the quality of life I envision will improve too.
And you've got two more years, and you and our president will both be facing the voters again.
President Obama, I'll tell you, you haven't asked about him. He is, he can't do anything wrong, in my opinion. I know that's probably not very popular. Don't really care. I think President Barack Hussein Obama is a genius. And I think that when I think about some of the things that I go through here in Cambridge, you know, little teeny, 11, 12, whatever it is, 1,000 people, and then I look at the weight that our president has to shoulder, I slap myself and say, shut up, Vicki. President can do it, so can you. So whatever is happening, I look at my president and I support him, and then I realize that if he can do it, I can do it too. I hope one day to meet President Barack Obama.
I'm sure you will.
I don't know. It's been 2.5 years. I haven't had it yet.
I think it'll happen.
I did get a Christmas card from the White House. So that was something. But the president is doing a good job. He is a brilliant man. I support him. If there's anything I can do to support our president, he's got it. Come down to the Hyatt one day and we'll have lunch. Wouldn't that be the coolest thing? I would be just, they'll have to pick me up from the floor. I would have fainted first, and then it's like, okay.
This has been a real pleasure to finally meet you in person.
It's been absolutely my pleasure. I read your emails. You guys pop your emails right to me all the time. It's like, oh my gosh, Steny Hoyer? Oh, wow, he's interviewing everybody. Who am I? I'm just a little old country girl from a little old town on the eastern shore of Maryland. That's my humble thing again.
There you go again.
I know. I'm not going to change that.
You shouldn't.
I'm not going to change.
And I thank you, Mayor Victoria Jackson Stanley, for inviting us into your city hall to meet with you.
It's been my absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Before we wrap up today's episode of On Delmarva, we're going to hear from our correspondent, Tom Horton. This week, Tom takes us on a 4,000-mile-long journey with the tundra swan. They cycle each year between Alaska's coastal plains and nesting grounds much further south, including right here on Delmarva.
Hello, I'm Tom Horton for On Delmarva. For human migrants, Delmarva is more island than peninsula, reachable only by a few bridges and the one ferry link between Cape May and Lewis. But if you're a migrating bird, well, the sky's the limit. Consider the epic journey of the tundra swan, my favorite winter waterfowl. Among the world's largest flighted birds, they grace Delmarva waters and fields by the thousands from November to March. Don't confuse them with snow geese, which are smaller, shorter-necked with black-tipped wings, or with the equally huge and elegant mute swans, which are oranger of beak and an invasive species that never migrates and seldom flies. You'll know the tundras by their whooping, hollering, and hallooing. If there's a wilder call in nature than what emanates from those 3-foot-long windpipes, I'd love to hear it. And there's no prettier sight than swans' 7-foot wingspreads silhouetted against a sunset as they glide in to roost for the night, or their brilliant white feathers aglow with early morning sun as they lift off to feed. Just last May, these same swans were winging along the jumbled, snow-covered peaks of the mighty Brooks Range, descending over a treeless plain that stretches to the frozen Arctic Ocean, preparing to nest on Alaska's North Slope. There and across Canada's Yukon territories, they take advantage of the far northern summer's long light and briefly abundant food to raise their young. Come September, advancing winter and shortening daylight goad the swans into setting off for Delmarva, some 4,000 miles away. And you gotta wonder why birds the size of Christmas turkeys would haul themselves every year of life on an 8,000-mile round trip for a few months on the Chesapeake. You'd think in all that way there'd be an easier place to set down. But it seems to suit the swans, and surely nature has designed them for the long haul. Wind tunnel tests show them to be among the most aerodynamic of all birds. And what a bonus for us. There's a British word, swan fall, coined to describe swans descending from on high at journey's end. The last leg of their trip here sees them airborne for more than 24 hours, flowing like a great river from the Canada-North Dakota border down to Delmarva, reaching altitudes up to 3 miles. You might see a swan fall if you watch the skies in mid to late November, just after a big cold front has blustered through. The swans ride the coattails of such nor'westers. Coming in so very high, their weary flocks first appear as mere flickers of light. Descending, they perform a balletic series of glides and whiffles, losing altitude by spilling air from their huge wings. They move ever lower, yelping, crooning. Amid this swan sound comes sharp, high-pitched weeping noises from the cygnets, the young swans making their first migration. Amazing to think they were eggs on the tundra just 5 months ago. As the big birds approach touchdown, their aerodynamic lines begin to reshape, sinuous and fluid as the reptiles from which they descended. Necks arched, breasts thrusting forward, big paddle feet swung smoothly down to break forward motion, massive wings cup, curve, back paddle, thresh the air with a sighing sound. Then a gentle plish of water parting to buoy and embrace the tired traveler. The glorious link from Arctic to Mid-Atlantic, Alaska to Delmarva, is complete. For the rest of the winter, the swans will feed and loaf. They used to mainly eat submerged grasses in their roots. Like geese and some ducks, they were able to adapt to feeding also in farm fields after pollution killed many of the grasses. Even so, about half the 40,000 that used to winter here when the grasses were healthy have shifted down to North Carolina. As February slips toward March and daylight lengthens, the adult swans will grow restless, preening and engaging in pair-bonding courtship rituals, bowing and head-bobbing and calling to one another. Humans find it heartwarming that swans mate for life, but it has more to do with efficiency than romance. A long migration and brief Arctic summer allow scant time to nest and raise young before it's time to hit the skies for Delmarva. And a couple that can get right down to it with no need to fool around is much more likely to meet such harsh deadlines. Come one day this March, when a southerly wind provides a boost, they will head north again. The sounds of their taking off, wingtips clopping on the water, will resound like thunderous applause, joined by a din of calling that echoes across the water like the baying of some otherworldly hound pack. Then silence. A few white feathers left floating on the tide. The bays and rivers will have lost their wildest voice until swanfall comes round again.
The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Justin Levy and Christina Arison. We're engineered by Brian Boone. Our theme music is by Wal Matthews of Clean Cuts. To hear this show again, podcast any of our past shows, hear additional interviews, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And for Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.